Hi everyone, and welcome to the Positive Education Podcast. My name is Ash Manuel, and before we get into today's guest, I just want to share with you about Wellbeing Wizard. Now, some of you may have heard about Wellbeing Wizard. It's an AI tool which is designed to make it a lot easier for educators and wellbeing leaders at schools to create the resources and content to teach wellbeing education or positive education to students. Now, what it is, it can do a whole lot. So we've trained the AI to be able to create on-demand and instant activities and lessons, and also games. Also, it has the capability of creating Pixar-style AI teaching videos, which would be really cool to explain the activities and the concepts, for example, of gratitude to students. You can create personalized wellbeing programs tailored for individual students' needs as well. And that's just some of the features. It's got some awesome features about also a variety of languages. So for the students of non-English speaking backgrounds as well. So it's about to launch. It's not far off, but we've got a waiting list at the moment. So if you, and we'll put the waiting list in the link in the show notes as well, but if you head to www.waitlist.scoreapp.com, you'll be able to join the waiting list there, and you'll be the first to know when it is released, and really, we're really excited about it. But today I want to introduce our guest. Now today's guest is Robert Hoff. Now I've been wanting to get Hoffy, as he's known by, on the podcast for probably over a year now. The reason being is when I was teaching at Emmanuel Primary School, he was the principal at the school for my entire 12 years. And I learned a lot from Hoffy. He ended up being a fantastic mentor. I found him to be a fantastic leader. He's now retired. Now, Hoffy was principal for 46 years in the Lutheran education system. Prior to that, he was also a teacher for 5 years. So he's had 51 years in education. So I wanted to dive really deep today about some of the key things that he's learned. So we talk about how he got into education, which is really interesting. We spoke about what he's learned about leadership and given some advice for the leaders of today in schools, which has been, I actually got a lot out of it myself and really wanted to learn about Hoffy's philosophy of leadership, about what he's learned, about also his future predictions for education. We speak about what makes a great principal, the strengths and gaps in education. And also, Hoffy was really big on wellbeing education or positive education a long time before it became, I guess, a part of the more mainstream education system. So he talks about the journey of that. And where he thinks it sits at the moment and where it's how it's changed over time. So this one is a great episode for everyone, teachers, but particularly for school leaders. Hoffy still mentors principals now. He actually received also a Order of Australia in 2024 and recognition of his service to primary education and professional association. So a fantastic episode. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you take a lot of things out of it as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the episode. If you would love you to do a favor as well, if you head over to the channel that you listen to on, whether that's the Spotify or Apple podcast or whatever it might be, and if you can leave us a 5-star review, that helps us reach a lot more people as well. We haven't really promoted that much yet about reviews because we just haven't, but would love you to send a review, 5-star review if you think you get value from it, and appreciate the support. So without further ado, we'll get into the episode with Robert Hoff. Hoffy, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, lovely to be here.
Now, I called you Hoffy because I don't think anyone calls you Hoffy except, nobody calls you Robert except Sandra.
That's right.
So, Hoffy it is. Yeah. Now, Hoffy,
I have been wanting to get you on this podcast for some time now because you're a great mentor for me as principal of Emmanuel Primary School, where personally I was there for 12 years. And how long were you there for?
21.
21.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're a great mentor, a great figure, and a massive impact. And really wanted to talk to you about your how you got into teaching and leadership and whole range of things to do with education. But I just want to start with a bit of a story. Must have been 2000 and, oh, I don't know, 11 or 12, Sunday after Sunday evening at the Grand Hotel at Glenelg, in there with a few mates, and you walked past. You weren't in the venue, but you saw me in there. We gave a big wave and said hello, and then you sort of rushed back to come in. And what happened when you got to the door and tried to come through?
Well, I was actually at a conference and we went down to get a drink. And we went to the door and they wouldn't let us in. And so, because there was a whole lot of very young people there. And so I waved at you and I went to the bloke and said, "Look, I'm Ashley's father. Let me in." I said, "I haven't seen him for 4 or 5 years. I'm just down in Adelaide at a conference." And the next thing, I was in.
Don't think you probably walked past him as you said it, and I think you missed a little part of that story, didn't they say that you were too old to come in?
At the door. No, mate, you're too old. Now, I was only 60 then. Oh, less than that. And they wouldn't let me in. No, very disappointing approach. But we got in.
You did, and that always stood out as a very funny moment, man. I really enjoyed that. Anyway, so I want to get to how you got into education. So you grew up in South Australia, spent some time in Queensland. But if you can just tell us about your childhood and how you got into education.
Yeah, sure. Well, I was a kid in the 1950s, and it was a fairly ordinary life in comparison to today. And I lived in Sefton Park, which was a newer suburb of Adelaide, and in the northern suburbs. And we had to walk to school, Nailsworth Primary School. And I must say there was a playground there, but it was all asphalt. Not a patch of green. Games were restricted to watching marbles flow down drains and chasing. There was only one PE lesson a week, and that was marching on a Friday morning.
That was the PE lesson
That
marching.
was it. There's nobody who taught PE in those days.
Wow.
And then the lucky students, there was only one team of footy, cricket, and netball. And the lucky students went off to Prospect Oval to play those activities. And the rest of us actually were child-minded and we did craft activities. So we were winding plastic around a bottle and making wicker baskets.
What? How did you? Or who got to go to the sport if you were good enough? Is that?
Well, I don't know how they made selections, but I had glasses, spectacles, and so you immediately
Automatically out.
automatically out. Then the curriculum was straight out of the textbook. Oh man, boring as. Then I went to a very large high school, Enfield High, with over 2,000 students. Some classes had 46 kids in them, 46 kids. And getting into co-curricular activities was almost impossible. So you couldn't get into cricket or footy, so I played lacrosse and table tennis. Table tennis.
Would have been like, I mean, they're quite popular now, but back in the day, they would have been not many. How many participants? Not a couple of teams, or was there
Yeah, two
two
teams.
teams?
And I so much desperately wanted to be with the big boys, but again, I think the glasses might have been a problem. So, thankfully, my church had great activities for youth, and I got heavily involved in those, including sporting teams. So finally, I could play cricket. And I have no doubt at all in my early life that the support of parents and grandparents was a feature of my upbringing, particularly with values, you know. And the modelling of my parents in terms of service to their neighbours, their relatives and the wider community made a lasting impression on me in terms of what life is really about.
Can I say something on that? Like when we were at Emmanuel, You used to talk about that to the students all the time. Service starts in the home. Yeah. And that's obviously where it came from, because that's one of the things that I've really like took from you, is that about serving others, but particularly for young people, serving others in the home, then in the school environment, and as they get older out in the wider community.
That's it.
Yeah.
Well, that's where it came from. I watched that. I saw my parents do it. I thought, well, this is life.
Mm.
We are built. You are sick of hearing that, at a man. We are built to serve.
Yeah.
That's what we'd say to the kids.
Yep.
So in terms of getting into teaching, there was a very wise pastor at the church I went to, and he said, Rob, I've been watching you. And I thought, uh-oh. I thought, there comes the discipline. And he said, you have the qualities to become a teacher and someday a leader.
Mm.
So that was enough motivation for me to consider doing something in the educational area.
Mm.
In year five, they made us write down three things that we'd like to be in the future. In year five, this was in primary school. And I wrote down pastor, policeman, and teacher.
We've probably been all three in some capacity in a funny way.
As a principal, you've had to be involved in the spiritual life of people, policemen ordering people around, arresting people, and of course, as a teacher, as a principal.
Yep.
So it's interesting, too, that I had some great older mentors when I was younger. The word mentor wasn't invented in the 60s. But they encouraged me into leadership activities, and I remember receiving a Rotary Youth Leadership Award when I was just 16.
Yep.
And that was a three-day leadership course that opened my eyes to the world because I was actually meeting with other people. I had no idea. We turned up at Westminster, and there was this three-day course, and you put it and you had to – it was – that was illuminating when I look back, that for sure.
And you can still, that was like when you were 16. So that still sticks with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's incredible. And just going back to
when I think about that now, I really do think that we should be doing more in training leaders for the future.
Mm.
But we'll talk about that later.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that was, so when you, so how did you, like, you wanted to, you end up going to education. How did it work back then? Like, did you go to a teacher's college? Do you get paid to study?
In those days, you only had to do leaving. You could matriculate in fourth year. And I did. And I applied. I was going to go and work for Woolworths because I could have had a scholarship there. Like, got a deal there. And I nearly signed that. I was going to work at a bank, but I applied for Wattle Park Teachers College, as it was then, and waited all of January. No letter, no letter, no letter. 3 days before, Dad rang up the group, the board, and they said, oh, yeah, we're looking at Robert. He academically, he doesn't quite have it. But they said, that pastor wrote a very good reference, and he'll probably get in on that reference. Day later, they rang back, and I got in.
Oh, there you go. And we're back. So from there, once you graduated, where did you end up teaching?
Well,
because how old were you?
I was 16 and a half.
When you started?
Yeah, in the teacher's college.
Oh, really?
So I was...
God, you're young.
I was 19 and a half when I started teaching at Hope Valley Primary School.
19 and a half when you were teaching?
That's it.
God.
Yeah.
And then,
yep.
So that's when you started teaching when you're 19 and a half, and then you became a principal at 24.
That's right.
And you were, I think you were, was it 46 years as a principal and over 50 years as an educator? Yeah.
That's it.
God, that's some kind of record. And we'll touch on this a bit later, but you last year in 2024, you became AM Order of Australia.
Yeah.
For your service for over 50 years of teaching, which is a big honour.
Yeah.
How did that... I guess what was that announced? How did you feel about receiving that AM?
Well, I was surprised, and some of my mates in the independent sector you never know who puts your name up for this.
Oh, not you get nominated. Yep.
Yeah, nominated, and they put it up, particularly for service to associations. I've been on national associations and state associations for years, mentoring people, showing an interest in them, and all of that. And so it was wonderful, really, when the letter came, and then you get the
Yeah,
award.
absolutely.
Yeah. No, it was, Sandra and I, my wife and I, were very delighted that
Yeah.
that was
Yep.
presented to
Yeah,
us.
no, I'm thoroughly well. 51 years of service as a teacher and 46 as a principal. That's probably the definition of getting an AM, really. And like studying, how did you, because you at 24, you became a principal. How did that come about and where was that?
Right. Well, in the education department, I quickly got promoted and ended up at Prospect Demonstration School. Demonstration schools were schools where you had a student teacher every day of the year,
Oh.
and you were selected as being a teacher of great methodology and organisation. And so you're in the demonstration school, so your peers were all top teachers. And then the idea was that out of those top teachers, they would train you to become leaders. Well, my own parish down at St. Paul Lutheran at Blair Athol started a school. And the same pastor who said, Robert, you're going to become a teacher and one day a leader was the pastor.
Ah, St.
And so
Paul's.
I was called to go there. And I think I was too young to be a principal.
24, I could, I don't know if I was,
Well, I was a smart aleck.
I don't even know what I was doing at 20. I
No,
hadn't even worked
no.
out what I wanted to do in life at 24 and barely dressed myself, I reckon, but becoming
Well,
a principal, that's a big achievement.
I fell into it, actually, and all the characteristics that the pastor said came to play, and I learned along the way. But Ashley, I had brilliant mentors. There was a principal from Maitland who would call every 2 weeks to come and see me. There's another principal, lovely chap here from St. John Sunley. He would ring up and say, how are you going? So the mentoring then, even though I wasn't in an association of principals yet, the mentoring from other principals was very, very helpful.
Where's that at today? Where do you think it, like the mentoring of other school leaders? Is that today? Is that still happen? Is
Yes,
it pretty good?
yes,
Yep.
yes. I think it's far more organised than it ever was.
Yep.
And particularly the big principal associations have set up mentoring. And I know in the education department, there's a lot of support for young principals, as much as you would need.
Yeah. And it's up to the principal to tap into that as well, I guess, and
Oh, it is. It
want to
is.
get better and want to be a leader.
Yeah.
It's yeah, it's, I just find that amazing at the age of 24 becoming a principal. And how long do you stay at St. Paul's for?
I was there 13 years,
Yep.
and then in the Lutheran system, you get invited by another school to be a principal. And in those days, you didn't put your hand up;
Ah.
you were invited.
Yep.
And so, I was invited to go to the Gold Coast. Can you believe? From this life here in Adelaide, up to the Gold Coast. Well, that was illuminating. Absolutely, another world, a completely different world. And that was a school that had just started. It's only a year old, and they'd had to release the principal at the time, release him.
You allowed to say what?
Well, he didn't fit. It
Right.
just didn't fit.
Fair enough.
And they had actually phoned me up several times, and I said, no, I'm a South
Yeah.
Australian. But we went to Queensland and with the kids, took the two little kids up there, and that was 13 years of terrific. That's when I actually started to get into associations and saw the value, the great value of having colleagues who you could talk to over a beer, over a meal. And you'd come home after talking to them thinking that, geez, things are not too bad here at this school, at my school. And I felt good about that.
Totally get it. So that was that in the 80s? So
That was in
13
the 80s.
years at St. Paul's, then 13, what school was it in, what,
Trinity,
Trinity on the Gold Coast? You would have been there when the Brisbane Bears
started.
started in the Gold
Yeah,
Coast.
I think I saw your uncle
Yes.
Indeed, start there.
And you employed him, didn't you?
Yes, yep,
So,
part time.
yes, yeah, so my uncle Mark Micken, Brisbane Bears' first ever captain, and back
Yep.
then it wasn't quite professional.
It wasn't.
No. And so, yeah,
It was like going to a country football team,
it
managed by
was.
two people who had money but had no idea
No,
about how to run a footy. So
yeah.
Mark Williams was up
Yep.
there. There were a lot of people who I knew. And then we came and we were invited to come back to on by this time you had to apply for jobs, but I got a phone call from Emmanuel to come back here.
And what year was that? That must have been
96, 97,
96,
97.
97. And then the Crows won the grand final in 97.
Correct.
So, yeah, and that's how, personally, that's how I guess we got connected, because my uncle Mark, like when I was graduating from teaching, I actually, you probably don't remember this, but he gave me, well, he told me to ring the school and ask for you, and we had a bit of a conversation, or maybe it was via email. And then didn't really think much of it, but then I went to the school, dropped off my resume, got called up for a half day PE relief
Yeah,
teaching
that's
job.
right.
And then just so happens that Sue Cook,
Yeah,
one of the PE teachers,
yeah.
was going on maternity leave for 5 terms. And Sally Ferguson,
Yeah.
who was deputy principal at the time, asked if I wanted to teaching or what plans were. And I said, oh, I don't really know. So
Yeah.
ended up applying for this role, got the job 3 days a week starting out at Emmanuel. And then we put an extra PE lesson a week. So at that time it was only one. Then we put it to two. And so we needed a new person. So I ended up becoming full time at the start of, well, started teaching there at Emmanuel in 2004, at the term of four, 2004, and then stayed there for 12 years. I love the school. Like, it was at the best time and learned so much. Not just like obviously like teaching, but like life skills as well from you and a lot of other people at the school as well. And as I said before, like that thing about like service, that always stuck with me. And to say, what is it today? Thursday, each Thursday of the month, third Thursday of the month, it's actually today, I do a volunteer thing, like at a, it's called Fred's Van. It's for vulnerable people, and they just come for a meal. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do stuff, because I realized I wasn't doing, or could have, sorry, could be doing more as a way of serving others. And that always stuck with me. And I was, personally, I'm not perfect at it, but I'm a lot very aware of it, that we should be doing things for other people, no matter how big or small. And that's one of the things that I reckon a lot of kids are taken away from that school as well.
Well, I'm hoping so. They still talk about that because right now, where we sit in the world, volunteering is disappearing fast. It's all about yourself and how your family can get on. There's very little about volunteering. And I learned a very good lesson from a very good, now departed mate of mine, Robert Ford, who said, if you can get children to see what their service does and how it changes people's lives, you've got them hooked for life. And that's why doing service activities in schools might have a bigger impact in the future on the number of volunteers that we have. Volunteers in Australia have decreased in all service clubs, Rotary, churches, like you wouldn't believe.
What do you think that is?
Self,
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 yeah.
Trump. Look at Trump. He's saying, no, we're not helping the vulnerable anymore. My goodness gracious me, that's not an attitude for progress at all.
Yeah. It's actually interesting you say that about seeing the impact that you do have when you do volunteer, because I coming to think of it now, like and I see Emmanuel on social media. When they might do a fundraiser, and then they'll get the group that they're fundraising for to come into assembly
That's
and explain the impact that it has had. So they do get that, I guess, that understanding of what they've raised money for, whatever it might be, how that is going to help people. And that's just a good way to show that as well. No, I just want to move on to like well-being in schools, because this is a positive education podcast. So I reckon you deserve a lot of credit, Hoppy, because you're one of the first teachers, or sorry, first leaders to really understand the benefit of well-being in schools. And I know that you, went over to, or went internationally to different conferences and came back with I think it's about 2012 or 2013, to really go down that path of embedding wellbeing or positive education across the school. So how has the approach to student and teacher wellbeing evolved, like, over your time, do you reckon?
Well, look, this question could be the topic of just one podcast.
Yeah,
so I'll try and be as brief as I can. It's a big task in schools today to be responsible for student and staff wellbeing.
Mm.
There's so many complicating factors, especially in terms of what the students and staff bring from home life every morning. How do I know what happened in the home last night?
Mm.
How do I know that last night a staff member's parents was told they'd lost their jobs or been diagnosed with a life-threatening disease? You can't know, and that's an issue. However, I've always believed there are positive foundations that any school community can put in place that can assist students and staff on their journey, and that's what the wellbeing movement is about.
Mm.
50 years ago, you know, I recall the social issues and disruptive family situations. They were there. Kids from really poor homes at Nazareth Primary School in the 1950s.
Yep.
The impact of poor parenting, mainly alcohol abuse in those days, kids coming to school with marks and bruises on their bodies, families separated, observing really, we looked at these really quiet kids, but they were not diagnosed.
Mm.
They were just sort of there.
Yep.
There were kids there, I'm sure, who had depression, but there was no whole school approach to this. So there's been positive changes. And I think the fact that every teacher is a teacher of wellbeing, I underlined that in my thinking a long time ago.
Yep.
And we've learned that wellbeing is not a separate subject as such, but it becomes something that's embedded in the culture of the school.
Mm.
It's not just the social worker where you handball the problem kids at this, or the wellbeing coordinator, or the deputy's task. It's everybody needing to be on board. Now, when I thought about that, I thought, well, what are we going to do? And I bumped into, I'd never heard about mindfulness.
Mm.
I didn't know what mindfulness was. But I bumped into some sessions with Seligman, Marty Seligman, when he came out here and was resident psychologist or whatever at St. Peter's College. Now, my mates introduced me to him and we had lunches and I went to sessions. And then I discovered about PERMA and the fundamental pillars that enable flourishing.
Mm.
So my eyes were opened, absolutely opened to this new concept. And I went to a lot of conferences, international conferences, listening to a wide range of speakers. And I thought, well, there's something in this. Now, what can I do to get this going in the school that I was principal of?
Mm.
So what I did, I got the leadership team and we immersed ourselves in research. And then we decided to invest in staff wellbeing.
Mm.
It's no good saying to the staff, we're going to do this wellbeing. No, we invested in staff wellbeing. If we wanted them to invest in student wellbeing, then they had to understand the basics of wellbeing principles, particularly when it comes to social and emotional intelligence. And you simply can't pretend to be focusing on wellbeing unless every staff member understands the key features of what creates a flourishing environment.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
So you would know, because you were part of this, Ashley.
Yes.
We spent nearly 2 years exploring the issues, remember? Before we set it off on any implementation. You were actually the chap later on that got the implementation going. The key was getting everybody involved in the PD sessions. You just can't send two here and two there and two there. As you know, we spent thousands of development dollars in that big hall by getting in some of the best people in Australia to help us to understand.
Yeah, absolutely.
That unless your own well-being was right,
mm.
how could you set yourself up to be a well-being leader of your class?
Mm. Absolutely. And I remember you saying a couple of years, like this is going back, oh, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago when we were having a conversation, and you mentioned something that's really stuck with me, and that was like as teachers, like as they get into the industry or they've been teaching for some time, even before that, like even going through their prac teaching, they know that teaching can be a challenging job or there will be challenges that come up. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
And you mentioned about how it's really important for teachers themselves to have strategies of how to deal with it. So if there are challenges that come up, what's going to work for me to move forward from that challenge or come up with some strategies that's going to help me with that? Because you've got to be responsible for yourself.
Yes.
Like you can have all these great ideas, but and that's the whole thing about the education of like the well-being education is that for yourself, like if you are not in a good headspace yourself, which is going to happen, and that could be external things that happen like at home, as you said before, and then you're bringing that to school. But like we need to be responsible for ourselves. And I know that for me, like physical activity is a huge one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's I think it's one of the most, that's one of the things that stuck with me. Like teachers need to come in, and not just teachers, but having those skills to understand, okay, when things don't go my way or having a bad day, I need to, this will help me if I do this. And just pointing out what works for you is really important.
Well, we've become a dependent society.
Mm.
You know, there will never be enough money to put psychologists in every school.
Yeah.
There will never be enough government intervention in difficult and challenging circumstances. And that's what Marty Seligman said. He said, my business as a psychologist was that all I was doing was putting Band-Aids on people. And he said, I had to look to what was happening before.
Mm.
And he said, I don't want people to get to the Band-Aid stage. I want them to work it out for themselves. Mm. And that's why the positive psychology process that he put in place, it makes a lot of sense.
It does.
Absolutely a lot of sense. And the place, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the place that it needs to be happening is in schools.
Yep.
That's where the kids are.
Yep.
You get them young on the right track, and then we won't, I don't want to harp on this, but we've become so dependent on somebody else fixing the problem for me.
Yeah.
When
100%.
No society has the capacity, financial capacity, to fix every child's problem.
Mm.
It's got to be nipped in the bud earlier, and positive life, mindfulness, all of that. If children have that, and I've seen that with my grandchildren, by the way.
Yep. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think one of the things that I've noticed in school, some will do like the positive psychology approach or the positive education or well-being, whatever you like to call it. They'll do it really well in patches. So they might do it for a term, but the issue is they don't do anything else for the rest of the year. And so it's not consistent. Did you find that as well?
Yep. You've got to have a passionate core of leaders that keep pushing it.
Yep.
And of course, at the beginning, teachers say, not another thing that we have to do. And so what we did was to pull out some other things. We didn't focus as much on training for literacy and mathematics and other activities. If you want well-being to be the focus of your school, then you have to be careful that you don't overload people.
Yeah.
But if you develop people and school them and give them the understanding of this, like yourself, you're a classic example of this. You took it on board and you've gone and explored further. And there are strategies that you can use to keep it going. And I think part of what you're doing is that, and there are other people who have written about how do you keep this movement going? Because as you said, concentrate on it for a term and then let it go.
Mm.
That's not the pathway.
Totally agree. It's that consistency over time. It's like anything. Like if you want to get good at something, you need to practice consistently. Like it's not going to happen overnight, but just consistent practice over time just leads to big results. And I think if we can give the opportunity, particularly for ourselves as educators, but also in turn, like at the same time, give the opportunity for young people. They're going to grow up with these like skills. It's going to be second nature to them.
Yes.
When it is executed well in the schools, but also at home as well. Like it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because I think like home, I mean, you'd know this more than me, but like having though when the school and the home are working well together, that's the ultimate thing. But sometimes it's not quite like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, does that make sense?
Can you remember? I remember when we started at Emmanuel, how much the parents loved this at the beginning. They thought this is different. Wow, this is what I could be doing at home. So how you bring parents along the way, and we did that. I mean, we brought in national and international speakers for parent nights there.
I remember Maggie Dent came for day and
Maggie
night.
She's still doing that and doing it very well.
Yep.
But it wasn't just a one only thing. It was that, and then the wellbeing coordinator used that stuff and keeps putting it out. It's a big issue in this life, this very rushed life that we lead. Everybody's leading a rushed life. How to calm down and think about some of these issues. That's why schools are in a great spot, providing somebody is leading it. And that's why I had no hesitation in employing a wellbeing coordinator.
Yeah, absolutely.
It costs money.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things, like it is a cost, but it's a great investment. Like it has to be, you have to have someone leading it, because what I've noticed, particularly probably in I think it's just the way the public system's set up. Like they might have a wellbeing leader, but the issue is the poor person in that role gets, as you said, mentioned before about putting band-aids on things. Things come up during the day that they've got to address, and then they don't have the time to implement a whole school approach.
That's right. So the wellbeing leader has to spend 50% of his or her time on training the staff to be out there, and as you said before, becoming a way of how things are done. If the 50% changes, where that person's only spending 20% on staff, encouraging them, because staff change and you get new staff in, then give the position away. Because you can be snowed under. You could put two social workers into a big school of 500, and it would make a difference. But that's not the answer. That's what Seligman said. Righto, Robert, how big's your school? 700. He said, I could put four people in there and we'd still be doing band-aid stuff. He said, but if two of the four were encouraging and training the teachers and other staff, by the way, he said, that's the way forward. So you've hit the nail on the head.
I think I just understood that philosophy as well, but it probably came from, like, looking back on it now, is from yourself pushing it that way. And isn't, like, you got to start with your staff. Like, you do. Like, you can, but it's not going to work. Like, if you come with a program without training your staff, it's going to be very, you're going to have one teacher who gets it. You have two who, I'm okay with this, but, and then you're going to have, like, 10 who don't even look at it.
The introduction of the primary years program to the curriculum. You just can't go to a conference and all come back and say that. So you've got to invest time and resources, and then you have a curriculum leader who's good at it and goes around to the classrooms and helps and understands. Unless you commit to the resources and the capacity to do this, then don't start.
I totally agree. And just want to move slightly different direction, Poffy. I guess, looking ahead, where do you see education in the next 10 years, and how do you think schools will need to adapt to meet future challenges? Where do you think school systems heading?
Well, that's another question for a whole podcast. I mean, the biggest change for me has been the changes in understanding over the last 20 years in of how children learn.
Interesting.
The sciences, what do you call those educational scientists? The scientists who've explored how the brain works, they've taught us such a lot. So over the years from the 50s, chalk and talk, and there was a prescribed curriculum, which most teachers used. They just used textbooks to teach from. Playing awful years of teach test, and specifically learning by objectives. Now, I've noticed the big change, particularly in primary school, the move to inquiry-based approach. You want to build critical thinking skills. You want to nurture curiosity. You want to promote them to solve complex problems. And the best framework I found for that, where everybody got involved, was the primary years program of the IB.
International baccalaureate, yep.
Now, what I noticed most of all, of lots of kids previous were switched off. They switched off on their learning, particularly in year four, about year four. I've kept records of this, particularly boys whose only interest in coming to school was sport. And for girls, often their only interest was friendship. Learning was on the back burner. Now, I saw how the best teachers turned these children around using the inquiry methodology. That's the big change that I've seen. It takes some work and understanding to teach in this way. It's not easy. But well, when the children really hooked on to the topics of the units of inquiry, it was all about engagement, or should I say re-engagement. Parents commented again, particularly from boys, how much research was going on in their learning. My lads are reading again. They're involved, and their learning is just fantastic. They wanted to come to school because of the learning. Now, if you can switch your school around to that, so there you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I must say, the last two schools I served in, Trinity and Emmanuel, had a secondary school attached. Now, I have two daughters who are leaders in secondary education, and I've noticed a similar story there, particularly say in the last 15 years ago. I see the Facebook pages of these schools, and I've noticed that the enterprising schools have a meaningful approach to engaging students. Sure, there are co-curricular activities, more co-active activities than ever before. And I just love the way that some schools are encouraging children. So, for example, in year 10, to go off campus and do a course at TAFE. Now, see, that's opened the door. Instead of being at school, sit, learning, science, no, we've got a pathway where you can go off for a course and go to TAFE. And those older kids, teenagers, there's a more flexible approach to curriculum delivery. That's what's changed. And this means that students are engaged, and when they're engaged, they succeed. And when they succeed, that's fantastic because that leads to a flourishing life.
Absolutely. I guess the inquiry-based learning it puts you in a direction about the things that you're interested in. Like you can start off with like a line of inquiry, which might be a question, and then they just go off in different directions about how they want to research it, or if they're going to a TAFE course, they might have something that they're really interested in. So it's quite flexible, isn't it?
It is. I've got a grandson in year 10 who goes off Tuesday on the bus from his school. So he's got to be independent. He's never been independent before. His parents have always taken him to school. He's got to go on the bus. This is in Brisbane. And he goes to TAFE and he's doing a physical education management
Oh,
course,
really?
which the school can't afford to put on. So, but the school has found pathways. And I think the schools that find the pathways for kids to excel are the schools that you give a big tick to.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really interesting, and really appreciate your time today. I hope we covered a lot of different topics, but I just wanted to reflect on your career. So, 77 now, years of age. You finished at Emmanuel in 2019, end of 2019.
18, middle of 2018.
To it, yep. So that's as
BC, before COVID.
yes, there you go. Before COVID, just was that you must have known what was coming. So what do you, I guess, reflecting back on your career life of over 50 years, like that's unbelievable, like service for a start. But I guess what's one of those things that you're most proud of? And I guess what legacy have you, or do you feel that you left in education?
Well, a legacy is always about leaving a place in a better situation than you found it. And that's not to knock the previous leaders by any stretch of imagination, because they were there in a certain time. But when you get there, that you've got your eye on the ball, you've got your eye on the future, and if you become satisfied with what you're doing, then you've lost the plot. You've got to keep going out and searching. And that's what I was able to do, because I was encouraged to do that by the school council. You're aware that I was often away, and I spent a lot of time looking at other schools and coming back thinking about, well, gee, that worked there. I wonder if it would work here. And discovering what others are doing. And so I guess the most important legacy for me was locating future leaders and encouraging them on the pathway to leadership, and particularly in schools and principalship. And I've counted up that 13 teachers have gone on that pathway and become principals.
Yeah, absolutely. And current principal at Manual Primary School is like Beck Clements, and she was a teacher for years before that, before she went overseas and came back and took over from you.
Luke Schoff, Jeff Mingy, I can name them all. And I feel good about that, you know.
Absolutely.
I do feel good about that. I think if we roll back, one of the things that I have learned about the role of a principal is to put together a good team. I always employed people who were better than me in aspects of schools life. They were better than me in managing curriculum, better in managing learning support, better me in managing finances and the like. But I knew my strengths, and they were often commented on. My strengths were often, I loved feedback. I loved good, honest feedback. I didn't like feedback from people who were not on the site all the time and saw everything that I did. But if the feedback is good, then you know that the strengths that you've got indeed are working. And I want to say this, that once you've got your leadership team together, it's important to give them the opportunity to grow. I hear so many principals who don't encourage these leaders to join professional associations, to get out. And so what's the point of employing them if you're not encouraging to look out and develop? We want flourishing leaders, and you have to have budgets to do that. So you say, yes, you can go here, there, again, go along. Aspiring leaders, do you want any points on aspiring leaders?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to hear like your thoughts on aspiring leaders, because I think like school is, it makes a huge difference. Like you hear stories of schools like maybe didn't have the best reputation at some stage, and then a new leadership has come in and it's turned it around. So yeah, I'd love to hear some more points about that.
Well, I reckon if you're an aspiring leader, you have to commit yourself to foundational learnings. You must do not necessarily a master's, but you've got to study leadership. What are the tenets, the basic tenets of leadership? If you don't do that, you never think about it, and you could be wasting a lot of time. So you do that. I believe you have to be yourself. You've got to know yourself and be yourself. You've got to learn from mistakes. And I made plenty of mistakes, usually with my mouth.
It's very funny. Like even before at Emmanuel, like I remember just on that, like I used to love it, one of my favorite things. You'd come in, it could be about anything like footy or something on the weekend. You'd go off, or you have a go like maybe like you know, I know you're not serious, but sort of like people think you are, and that's why I think I really got you from the start about when you're like having a go or your humour actually comes across. I think he's been serious, but then I actually realised that you weren't. Like people think that you are serious sometimes when you're not.
That's right. Humor's a very important gift. And And people must see you having fun. If you're never going to join in anything, and if you never do anything stupid like at concerts, the staff always did a humorous act. So
Absolutely.
the kids could see that we were real.
All
But
sports
get
days,
back to aspiring leaders. You've got to find an authentic mentor. You've got to have an interest outside of the educational community. All the people, I still mentor people, and I say, what is your interest outside of the community? And fortunately, some are managers of the local football team. Others have joined up in the country. They joined the service, the Red Cross or ambulance,
CFS, oh, ambulance, yep.
others are presidents or leaders of national associations that have got nothing to do with schools. And I give those people a tick because that's what keeps your it keeps you emotionally healthy and sometimes spiritually alive too.
Absolutely.
And you've got to have something to look forward to. Every week I had something to look forward to. Every month I had something on the calendar where we were going to a dinner or going away. Every term I had something to look forward to. Every year, yes, I'm going to Reggio Emilia this year for early childhood. Something to look forward to. Now, the last thing to say is on aspiring leaders and leaders, use the gift of long service leave. Do you know, Ash, that there is no long service leave in England? There is no long service leave in America. We have got a gift here, precious gift in Australia, and use it when it comes up. I see too many people save it or cash it out. Leadership is demanding, and it can sap you of physical energy, psychological strength, and spiritual soul matters easily. Restoration is the key to success as a leader, as is laughter and collegiality. So that's why developing collegial friends through associations is absolutely essential. And that's what kept me afloat for the 46 years. When I reflect back on that, 46 years, how did you do it, Robert? It was my association mates and colleagues. Absolutely essential for well-being. I can't tell you how many times I drove home after a lunch or a dinner with my mates, and I got in the car and I said to myself, Hoffy, you're not in such a bad situation after all, because I listened to their war stories and I'm thinking, God, you're going all right, Rob. But if I didn't have that, I'd be perhaps wallowing and going down the tube. But getting out with them is one of the secrets.
Absolutely. I think you made a really good point before about having, like, going back a little bit ago about how you mentioned about having those assistant principals or deputy principals, the other leaders who can complement what you. So you've got your strength and they've got their strengths. And having that, I guess, removing your ego and understanding that they're better than you at some things, that's a really important skill. And one that stands out to me that I know a lot of other people better than you at was remembering names.
Yeah, I couldn't.
I
Who are you, Ash?
remember some times in assembly when you'd be recognizing your teacher. And you just had a mental blank and you couldn't remember that they've probably been there for about 30 years. And Luke Schoff was just off the side like a meter and he had to whisper. He was a name whisperer.
That's it. He was a name whisperer. And yet I can tell people's ages. So the other week we're at an old mate's 70th. And the kids were there who went to Emmanuel. And I said, oh, I've forgotten your name. Oh, I shouldn't remember your name. But I said, you're 32.
And yeah,
And they
right.
said, spot on. Last week I was at the Crows footy and up in a booth, and an ex-student came and said, Mr. Hoff, what are you doing here? I said, oh, I'm a guest. And they said, oh, you remember me? And I said, yeah, you're a session. And you're 34. So some names come back, but the ages, I've got this funny gift for ages, which means absolutely nothing. Could we finish on where schools will be in 10 years'
Yeah,
time,
absolutely. Go for it.
right? If you've
Yep.
got time.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. I hope they become places where young people not only continue to flourish in all aspects of their development, but that there'll be enough people who love working with the coming generations. There is a teacher shortage now. I hear about it from my colleagues ever since COVID, and it's quite alarming. My two daughters tell me all the time, my other mates who I just say, we can't get teachers, we can't. That in 10 years' time, we've got to be able, we've got to create the teachers who, but people now who will want to be there. And it's interesting that some students who went to Emmanuel, who had the capacity, I must say, to be leading doctors, surgeons, physicians, have decided to be teachers. That warms my heart marvelously. But there is this shortage because we can't have flourishing schools if we don't have flourishing teachers. So
How do you fix that? What's the key, you reckon?
I ask myself, will salary increases be part of the answer? I'm not sure. I'm not sure about if suddenly we go, the top teacher, say, gets 120,000 now. If you suddenly said 150, would the 30,000 make a difference? It might. But then that's a tremendous thing for a government to do, because then the police will want it and the nurses will want it. And so whether we have the capacity to do that, I think teachers, current teachers themselves, have to do the work of marketing. They are the ones
True.
who at schools, high schools, or even in primary schools, encourage people to think about what it is to be a teacher. The other thing is, things that put some people off is the number of regulations and government requirements, dealing with parental expectations. That does put people off, but I don't know how you go about that. But this is why I think it's so important for leaders to be constantly developing schools where flourishing work cultures are being developed. That is the secret, I believe. You ask me, that's the secret. Flourishing work cultures. I think that enterprise bargaining in schools has not worked out. And I've got a whole podcast ready for you, Ashley, to go about that. Because I was around, been around long enough when EB was developed, and it was developed for industries. It was developed for industries, and somebody's decided to put it on schools. Schools are not industries. We don't make a product and then count how many products we've made and how well we're selling it. That might work in industries, but not in schools. Schools are people development places. And so future leaders will need to find ways of making the school work site places that teachers love being a part of. I love being at Emmanuel because, and part of, they want to be connected to, and they want to be committed to. And so the work culture has to be reasonable. There's a good word that we can spend a debate on. Reasonable work culture enabling staff to flourish. I finish with this word, these words. Where teachers flourish, students flourish.
Absolutely. Totally agree with that. And obviously, I know we have to wrap this up now, but really appreciate your time. We're actually in person. Normally I do these over Zoom, but we're actually in person. We're face to face today, which is fantastic. And yeah, really appreciate your time and sharing all your knowledge and wisdom. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to take a lot of value away from this episode today.
I hope so, Ashley. I hope so. Happy to
Absolutely.
share those thoughts with you. We've been a bit long on some of the answers. That's my fault.
No,
But when you've got this built-up knowledge, you like to share
no. Oh,
it.
we could talk for about days on this. So no, I really appreciate your time and thanks for sharing your knowledge.
Yep, righto. All the best, Ash,
Thanks, Avi.
on the journey.